The FPL problem is a really, it's a classic one in the business, in the quantum, in the non-classical realm of condensed matter physics. And I agree completely with Ron that there's a wonderful interaction between theory and experiment that's not just possible there, but that's essential. We need the theory to motivate and to guide experiments in the first place. And then even after we've made measurements, we need the theory to try and figure out what's going on. I'm a little surprised that you've taken those Badreau measurements at such face value, and I don't know if you've looked at them at all. Experiments in this pressure range are complicated. It's just an aside. They're looking through the side of a sample, so like more than 90% of their signal is irrelevant to the problem. It's looking at the wrong part of the sample. So there's some. I'm just a little surprised. I actually agree with you. I don't think that the issue is settled, and I certainly think that the interpretation of the MOSFAR data is equivocal in the sense that basically it's a Zeeman-like magnetic splitting there or not, and I think that's what you can say for those.
But the Badreau thing in their favor, the FA203 case, they clearly see
something
reproducible, the loss of that peak there.
Right, and that also doesn't match with the MOSFAR, so.
But again, it's consistent with the MOSFAR, because I think the MOSFAR is, like you just said, is seeing a different thing. So, if you still have local moments, then as you go through and deal. It's known in these materials, cobalt oxide, FeO, and so forth, that above the nail temperature, there's still local moments.
Right.
Zero pressure, even. But if you do MOSFAR, you go to a very sharp, I probably got it up here somewhere, a very sharp spectrum above the nail temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So,
So what you must have covered last week was idea that perovskite is the dominant form down the lower mantle, or one of the dominant phases in the lower mantle.
It must have gotten mentioned, sure. You can say it again.
I feel I need to step back and review a couple of things. Yes.
That's fine, that's good for us.
Yeah, okay. Let me make a few comments. How do we know what's down there? And it's actually remarkably difficult, because what we know from direct sampling, what we really, really know of, we can only assure comes from the shallowest regions of the Earth, a few hundred kilometers. Now, there are hints and indications, very exciting ones, and I don't have any reason to disbelieve them, that there are samples that come from as far down as the lower mantle that have been recovered to the surface of the Earth, that they're extremely out of equilibrium. And in fact, even the proponents of those interpretations, they admit that what they're looking at is stuff that is partly converted back down to low pressure forms, partly or largely converted back. So it's very controversial to say that we've actually sampled anything more than 100 or 200 kilometers. That depth is not controversial, because there's one thing that we get from those kinds of depths that everyone agrees about, and that's diamonds. Okay, you know you need about 5 GPa, about 150 kilometers worth of depth to make diamond. That's big single crystals. So then the other source of data you have is geophysical observation, and that's primarily from seismology. And Ron didn't really go into this, but if you go into the laboratory and take the minerals, which are complicated magnesium iron silicates, and squeeze on them at high pressures and temperatures, they all break down to form this perovskite plus oxide mixture that Ron was talking about. So that's observation number one, is experimental. Number two is you can compare the properties, and I didn't bring slides either, so I'll just say it in words. You can compare the elastic properties of this perovskite plus oxide mixture, then detail a couple of perovskites and da 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 da. It doesn't matter. You can compare that against the seismological observations of the elastic wave velocities and densities of the deep interior. Three separate observations, because there are two wave velocities, longitudinal and shear, and the density. All three are effectively measured if you take into account the normal mode measurements, the free oscillation measurements of the Earth. And you find that the leading order, to within a few percent, these agree tremendously with each other. So you take rocks from the upper surface, reproduce the conditions deep down, and you create properties that really match what's down there. Now the state of the art in the community is, do they exactly match, or are they a little bit off? Those are areas of various levels of debate, but to first order, there's no question about that correspondence. Now, give that as an introduction, because the same arguments are used for the core with an extra elaboration. And that is, you know, with the core, we know its density. It's much higher. It's roughly twice the density of the mantle. We have a strong presumption that it's electrically conducting because of the strong arguments that that's where the magnetic field is created. And so then the extra twist that's added on is really from cosmochemistry is that the only element that comes close to having the right, the only elements are within orders of magnitude in terms of abundance that they could be on there is iron. It matches meteorites and such observations. Now that's not an exact proof. And the real problem that Ron alluded to is that the density of the outer core is not exactly that of iron. It's clearly off by like 10%. It's not a 1 or 2% arguable thing. It's a 10%, 12%, you know, 10 plus or minus 1 or 2% kind of offset. So there's clearly other stuff down there. Could it be what was originally put down there is not pure iron, like some sort of sulfide form? There are sulfides that are found in meteorites. Could it be, on the other hand, that what was put down there has reacted over geological time to suck in oxygen, which is something that Ron alluded to? We don't know. But that's the kind of motivation that one has for doing experiments. And again, this has been very frustrating that if you do some experiments, you'd like to see people follow them up, and very few people have been following them up until the last year or two. So the idea is that we have a rocky or an oxide-rich portion. Dave has made the point many times, this is 55% oxygen on an atomic basis with all the other magnesium, silicon, aluminum, calcium in the interstices, the metallic core, and what happens to this mixture when you look at them. And so we've actually done experiments since then, but the main work in my group was done about a dozen years ago. And this is actually what you find at high pressures, in the pressure range from about, actually, from about half this pressure, from about 40 GPa to about 120 GPa, which is the pressure range we've done, take a little foil of iron and heat it. Well, actually, you have to first form some perovskite at high pressure, some silicate perovskite, and put these two together and then heat the interface between the two and melt the iron. What you find is the formation of reaction zones. You can see those, but a bit by eye. But more importantly, you can probe what's actually in there. And so if you start off with, this is a hypothetical pristine core of pure Fe and a pristine mantle with this high pressure silicate perovskite phase. You heat them together at high pressures. What you actually form is some iron silicon alloy, in fact, some iron oxide alloy, and then some insulating oxides that coexist with that. And this is one of the reasons why, very specifically, one would want to know the properties of iron oxide, because experiments such as this really show that that actual material is plausibly down there. Aside from the more generic statement that in some sense iron oxide is like a zeroth order model for the entire planet, for a terrestrial planet. So you can look at it either way. This is a big picture way of looking at it. The other way is to simply say, well, you actually form this iron oxide, and you can find it in there by X-ray diffraction and so on and so forth. So let me go on from there and pull back from these kinds of observations and talk about the geophysical observations of the core metal boundary and why we think it's important from a general point of view for terrestrial planets. So this is from several years ago, sort of a cutaway just because someone else was able to draw the picture better than we were. But these are the seismologically observed average properties with depth in the Earth. The density is in blue. The shear wave velocity is in green, in this light green, and the compressional wave velocity is in purple. So roughly halfway down in the Earth, there's this huge increase in density that I alluded to. And in fact, major changes in the seismic wave velocities is determined through a combination of the wave propagation travel times and the free oscillation frequencies. And so seismology or geophysics by itself tells you that the interface between the core and the mantle has larger contrasting properties than anything else that our planet has, including the surface that we happen to stand on. So that's why the joke is this is the real surface of the Earth and we just happen to stand here. So these are the average properties. But in fact, seismology for the past 10 or 12 years has really tried, 10 to 15 years, has really tried to go way beyond these average profiles and look at variations around the averages. And why is that? Two reasons. One very practical This is from the so-called preliminary reference Earth model. So you would think they would make a final reference Earth model, except it would then have the strange acronym of FREM instead of PREM. But the fact is that one cannot do better, fundamentally cannot do better than this preliminary reference Earth model, because different people, or even the same people looking at different data sets, will simply get variations around these values of, in particular, the velocities, where you have very good resolution, but even density, will get variations. And finally, 15 or 20 years ago, the seismologists realized this is intrinsic. We can't really do any better in terms of a 1D model. We have to look at the lateral heterogeneities. So that was a practical reason for looking at,
Irrelevant question, actually.
No, no.
On the inner core, that's a solid iron.
Yeah.
I read in a place like Science that it's actually rotating somewhat different here from the rest of the Earth.
That is as a suggestion. That's actually quite controversial.
Okay.
And I believe it's fair to say that that was initially a theoretical prediction. Right. And then there were a couple of sets of observations that seemed to support that. There are competing observations that say, no, it's not rotating at a different rate. I think in one case, someone even claimed it was rotating in the opposite direction. Oh. So it's really, I think, if I can say, up in the air right now as a result. Theoretically, there are some reasons to believe it might be rotating at a slightly different rate, but even the theory is somewhat controversial.
Yeah.
From a magnetic calculation, the set of calculations, you expect slightly different rotation rate, but there may be some linkage between heterogeneities in density in the inner core, if it's inhomogeneous, that might lock it, essentially rotationally lock it with a mantle. So it turns out it's a dynamically very interesting issue right now. Let me make a couple of comments. As long as I was not going to talk about the inner core, but a diagram like this really exaggerates the significance of the inner core. You know, it's apparent volume. We're talking, it's at the percent magnitude for the planet. It's remarkable that the seismologists can get variations in density, basically an estimate for how much the density changes across the outer core, liquid to crystalline inner core boundary. And remember, this is done with normal modes that have to go to zero amplitude at the center of the Earth by symmetry. So they're tickling of the order of a percent, 10 to the minus 2 of the planet, and getting properties like the density jump down there. It's a real tribute to the kind of observational work that we've done.
Whatever mentions the nickel content.
Very good. Okay. This is exactly the right venue to raise some of these questions. So if you go and look at meteorites, they basically don't have pure iron. The closest thing you have to an iron alloy phase is an iron nickel phase. And so if you use meteorites as an analogy as representative of the last crumbs of what the planet was put together from, you'd expect nickel to be down there. The problem is that already about 40 years ago, it was demonstrated that you cannot distinguish the properties between iron and iron-nickel alloy. From a practical point of view, we can't tell geophysically whether there's a lot of nickel down there or not. So we just turn to our colleagues, the meteoriticists, and say, what's your best estimate for average amount of nickel down there? But it's a relevant point. If you're going to make calculation, really sophisticated calculation, that would be sort of the next thing you would start worrying about. And especially in the context, would you start getting oxygen combining with the nickel as well as the iron down here? Okay, so it's a good point. We haven't dealt with that.
Would it change the profiles?
First of all, these are purely observed profiles. These are data from seismology. Now, how you interpret those profiles, it might. And I have to say, we've done a tiny bit of work with iron-nickel alloys. As I was going to say, we in the community, we in my group, but also we in the community. And so far, we don't see huge differences because we are talking about like 10%, maybe 20% nickel. And so we think it's still a minority constituent, but I don't think it's going to look bad enough. So the person who drew this cartoon was trying to illustrate, as a result of the kinds of experiments I showed you, the theme of this particular paper was this could be all sorts of stuff going on between the mantle and the core, because if you go to the laboratory and take liquid iron and put it in contact with the kinds of oxides and silicates that you get out there, you see chemical reactions. So the speculation is it might be happening down there. Okay. So seismology, I don't want to go into a big digression about seismology, but the state of the art has been to do tomographic imaging of the Earth's interior, and it really is not like CAT scans, it's really more like ultrasonic imaging that's used for fetal imaging. And there's some significant problems with doing that, but I again want to emphasize that our colleagues in seismology are doing an incredible job. This shows the results of four different models for lateral or horizontal variations in wave velocities across a transect that goes through the mid-Pacific. It's done by four groups. This is a group at UC San Diego, this is a group in Texas, a group at Berkeley, and a group at Harvard. What they've done is actually strip away the average velocity variation with depth through the mantle. What I just showed you as the preliminary reference model, they stripped that away. And these colors indicate local deviations away from that, with red meaning up to a couple of percent lower shear wave velocity, and blue meaning up to a couple of percent increased shear wave velocity. The reason I use this color scheme is because of the idea, and some might really say the prejudice, that where the velocity is low, one interpretation is that that's because locally there the rock is hot. You know, if you go in the laboratory and heat up rock, the elastic moduli go down, the velocities go down. So this would be like hot regions, and these would be like cold regions. But there are many other ways of getting velocity variations. And worse than that, in a sense, is that depending on how you do the tomography, you have to remember, the reason this is not like just CAT scan tomography is the paths are not straight. Okay, so the actual, well, you guys know about this kind of stuff. The lateral variations that you're probing actually contort the ray pass. The magnitudes are reasonably comparable. Let me turn around and give the optimistic spin. The magnitudes are reasonably comparable, and if you sort of blur your eyes reasonably well, you do see some anomalies, like under this region of the Southwest Pacific, right above the Coromandel Boundary. I think I didn't say this strongly enough. This is the surface. This is the Coromandel Boundary. These are slices through the rocky mantle of the Earth. You see patches of low velocity at the Coromandel Boundary, according to several different models. This is right at the Coromandel Boundary. Okay. Let me just say that as far as seismology has been able to see, there are absolutely no horizontal or lateral variations in the outer core of the Earth, in the liquid outer core. That's been looked for by several groups. No one's ever seen it. In the inner core of the Earth, which is at under 2% of the volume of the planet, there are hints of lateral heterogeneity. They're controversial. I happen to think the evidence is pretty promising, it's pretty good for that, but I know it's a controversial subject. But in the mantle of the Earth, there are lateral heterogeneities. And so now, you know, you get back to why do seismologists worry about this? Because to the degree that these reflect variations in either the material or the temperature or some other variable, this is what drives the large-scale tectonics of the planet, the solid-state convection of the mantle. And so if you take these kinds of models and simply look at the RMS variations, plus or minus variations, in shear wave velocity, this is the kind of thing that you see. That near the surface of the Earth, there's a lot of variations, and this is the crust of the Earth up here. This is the Coromandel Boundary. Near the Coromandel Boundary, and this band encompasses all the models that I showed you and a few others, there's a lot of heterogeneity. But much of the mid-mantle, so the boundary between the upper mantle and the lower mantle is right around here at about 700 kilometers depth. Much of the middle mantle is really pretty boring and smooth and not much heterogeneity here. So one of the features that we think is observational that indicates something interesting going on down there is the fact that indeed there's a lot of heterogeneity down there. Now I'm of the opinion that this plot is hugely biased because you see it shows variations of the order of a percent or percent and a half. In fact, the seismic waves that are used to probe the mantle core boundary are significantly aliasing, I think, spatially aliasing the actual heterogeneities down there. Let me tell you why that is. So first of all, I showed you some cross sections with blue and red colors. Let me show you a map view of the Coromandel boundary in terms of these blue and red colors. And again, remind you that the Southwest Pacific, according to all of the models I showed you, but this happens to be by my colleagues at Berkeley, shows relatively slow velocities by a couple of percent. But I have to emphasize that this is based on an analysis of tomographic-like imaging that averages over at least many, many hundreds and really upwards of 1,000 to almost 2,000 kilometers laterally. So we're getting a lot of smearing. One of the direct observational lines of evidence that that's the case is people have gone in specific locations and done a different kind of probing with seismic waves. Rather than just looking at the travel time, where you have to unravel, so the travel time is integrated along the entire path. Indeed, it's mostly it's to some degree dominated by what's happening around the turning point and the deepest penetration of the seismic ray. But in fact, there's a totally different method which has been very much pushed at Caltech over the years by Don Halberman and his colleagues, which is to look at the amplitudes, the actual waveform itself. And you guys know from the analogy with optics that that tells you not about the integrated heterogeneity and velocity. That actually can tell you about the local gradient in velocity. So that gives you very high spatial information. This is the kind of thing that you get from those types of studies. And these are really done by, I would say, largely the descendants of the Caltech group, but with quite a bit of involvement and collaboration by the Caltech group. So in different parts of the world, you can look at the lowermost part of the mantle. Core mantle boundaries at nearly 2,900 kilometers depth. And this just shows the last few hundred kilometers at the base of the mantle. The average one-dimensional Earth model trend is shown in gray. And what's indicated is that from one spot to another, for example, if you look under India, this is this blue thing, you see some very funny structures, some rather strange, to some degree, the velocities are a little lower than you expect, and then just as you get into the core mantle boundary, they get a little bit too high and maybe sneak back down low. Actually, this slight anomaly in velocity is still not very well understood. What I'm going to focus on, though, briefly, because it's been focused on by the community, is in some locations, as indicated by this red circle here, for the South Pacific, you actually find that the wave velocities go off scale on a plot like this. So instead of being a 1% or a 2% effect, which is sort of the width of this plot right here, you actually see a tens of percent variation in velocity, and in particular, a reduction in velocity. So these are labeled as ultra-low velocity zones. That's at least the interpretation. Let me tell you very briefly how those have been discovered.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is there a correlation there with the position of the continents in the map?
I'll come back to that. Okay. Not directly, but there is a controversial suggestion of a related kind of correlation. So let me come back to that.
That lowest velocity zone right at the core mantle boundary where you would expect it to be softer.
Maybe, but let me come back. This is one interpretation of the data. Let me tell you briefly what the nature of the data is. First of all, you have to look at seismic waves that sort of kiss the core mantle boundary and sample it, go along the core mantle boundary, sort of graze along it. Now, you have some advantages in that there's a huge contrast in index of refraction and velocities as you go across the core mantle boundary. You can look at seismic waves. What you'd like to do is compare seismic waves against nearly equivalent seismic waves. So, for example, if you have an earthquake that sends out in this case, a shear wave that goes into the outer core of the Earth, so it has to convert from a shear to a longitudinal wave, goes back to a shear wave up to some seismic station. You can use that to compare against a nearly identical seismic wave, a seismic ray that's about at a slightly shallower angle so that it ends up grazing along the core mantle boundary. Now, the geometry will look strange to you because you have to remember that these are very large contrasts in index of refraction. So these focusing and defocusing effects are actually very big. And so the so-called shear to diffracted compressional wave to core wave back to shear wave, that would be this branch like this, can be compared against the very, very nearly equivalent shear wave that goes to the core and back to the mantle as a shear wave. And the reason you have to do that is you've got to strip away all of the complications up above the core mantle boundary. And in fact, if you look at these kinds of waves, and there's a mirror symmetry, you cannot distinguish it from a wave that enters in, goes as a shear wave, goes to a core compressional wave, and then kisses the core mantle boundary at the other side. If you look at these kinds of waves in a little more detail, what's happening is you're actually looking, so this is now taking this region and tilting it over here. You're looking at a wave that's grazing along what may be a waveguide or an anti-guide, depending on what the velocity contrasts are in here. So that's been studied for by a number of people. The work I've done has been in collaboration with one of Don Helmberger's former students, Ed Garnero, who's now at Arizona State University. And what you do is look at specific ray paths from a set of earthquakes, for example, from the Southwest Pacific, recorded at a bunch of stations, for example, in North America. The yellow lines here indicate where the rays are entering in and just kissing that Coromandel boundary, either on the entry point or on the exit point. Now, I'm not going to go back into this kind of detail, but just to say, in order to determine whether this ultra-low velocity or this anomalous zone is under the Southwest Pacific or under North America, you need some cross-cutting rays from another set of earthquakes and observations. Okay, so all that's been done, actually. A fair amount of work has been done in this domain. And the other, what's been superimposed on top of this is, again, this blue and red variation in seismic wave velocities at the Coromandel boundary, according to the very low-resolution kind of tomographic inversions. So, I won't belabor this, but as a function of distance, you look at the seismic waves and the way they move out, so-called movement out. So this shows, the kind of thing that the seismologists are doing. What you have in black is a set of observations for a sequence of stations recording one particular earthquake. It's actually the pass that I showed you. And then in red are the synthetic seismograms that have been calculated for almost exactly this prem structure, but they've added in a very anomalous little zone at the bottom of the mantle. And I'll tell you what that does. I think we'll come back to it in another figure, so you don't have to just take my word for it. If you don't add in this anomalous structure at the bottom of the mantle, you do not get the second peak that shows up here. You do not see it. Whereas if you do add it in and you match exactly the contrast in velocity and the thickness and so on, you do map out this variation, this second arrival that comes in. There's some variations in detail, but you do a pretty good job. And this was then the first set of observations to support this idea of very, very funny patches of very funny material at the Coromandel boundary. Lots of trade-offs. And it's just to say, I'm not going to show this. So the initial interpretation was the best way to do this, to arrive at these actual waveforms, was by having the mantle then at the bottom, little patches that are really distinct and more core-like in their properties, very low velocity, okay? And so the interpretation was maybe these are patches of molten material at the bottom of the mantle. Possibly that's still the favorite interpretation of the past, certainly since 96, it's off the board here. I won't belabor this, but you can calculate how the compressional wave velocity and the shear wave velocity will vary as a fraction of melt, and you can indeed get many tens of percent variations in wave velocity with just a little bit of melt in there. So that led to beautiful cartoons like this, I think was published in Nature. It's
You said you had a conversion of the shear wave into a pressure wave through the liquid part of the core. How do you distinguish that from the pressure wave, which was initiated at the same time?
Very good. There are a couple of ways to do that. One is that we know enough about the structure of the mantle that you can actually backtrack the ray paths for different combinations of compressional and shear, because they have different velocities, so they have different refraction angles. So actually that can be done nowadays in a straightforward manner. But there's some beautiful studies that were done decades ago to really separate out these different contributions. So for example, for the shear waves, you have two polarizations that for an isotropic medium are equivalent. And then depending, so what you do is you rotate into a frame of reference that has one polarization that comes in parallel to the mantle pore boundary and the other one perpendicular. What you can show is that only the polarization of shear wave that's perpendicular to the mantle pore boundary pounds on the core to generate a compressional wave, okay? Whereas the other one just shakes the core and doesn't transmit any energy. So beautiful work that's been done in classical seismology. And that's the kind of background you need then to look at the variations to then infer these kinds of, you know, wonderful cartoons of hot patches, ultra-low velocity zones, hot patches right at the mantle core boundary. Could these be places where there's partial melting, where there's chemical reaction? You know, one can begin speculating the way, not just geophysicists, but a lot of us would like to do.
And correlate with convecting cells.
This is the kind of thing you'd like to do. So let me show, it's a poor reproduction, I'm not doing justice to Dave's colleague Don Helmberger, but there's some really beautiful, beautiful studies that have been done. For example, we know that Iceland sits on the mid-Atlantic ridge, the mid-oceanic ridge, where there's material upwelling at the surface of the Earth, upwelling volcanically, and Iceland actually sticks up above the ocean ocean surface. And so in one particular study a couple of years ago, the group at Caltech looked at a series of earthquake to station combinations such that some of the ray paths travel more or less underneath Iceland and some of them do not. And I don't want to make a big deal out of this, but what they found is a sequence of either what they call normal mantle, where there is no anomaly, as I claim, so there's no second peak, versus anomalous mantle, where you do get the second peak, so I've highlighted it in orange. These are synthetic seismograms that have been calculated. You can see you can make this secondary peak really, really humongous if you want. The point is you need to stick in something weird down the bottom of the mantle, and better than that, you can outline where it shows up and where it doesn't. And it shows up for these orange stations relative to this one set of earthquakes down here and not the green ones. So this gives you an idea to start imaging and saying we have an anomalous patch underneath Iceland, which is one of our so-called hotspots, one of these places where a lot of volcanic material and heat is coming out of the Earth's interior, but not if you're offset from there. So that's a correlation. It's just an example of one. It's the kind of correlation that, you know, gives you some reason to get excited. And another one, and get a paper in Nature, I think it was. And another one, which is a slight variation, that's why I want to put this up. This is from descendants of Helmberger at Caltech. This is from the group at Santa Cruz. They did a slight variation on this. They looked at paths that intersect underneath the Hawaiian Islands, or very near Hawaiian Islands, which is actually the largest so-called hot spot, the largest emanation of heat and volcanic products, largest in terms of heat flow, if you want to think of it that way, for coming out of the surface of the Earth. And here, instead of looking at the seismic wave velocities, they basically looked at preferential velocities versus orientation, if you want, anisotropy. And I'm not going to go through their actual set of observations they made, but just to say that they had indications of anisotropy, that is directions in which the seismic waves go faster relative to other directions, that can be interpreted in terms of lining up of crystals at the bottom of the mantle associated with a flow pattern, very much as you might expect at the bottom of an upwelling plume or something like this. Now, behind this interpretation, of course, is a lot of imagination, some very good science in going from this model to the observations. But this is not a unique interpretation, obviously. It's just to say that things hang together pretty well with this idea of anomalies in both the velocities and also the anisotropy, the base of the mantle. So how many of these funny patches have been found? Well, very quickly, people were able to sample nearly half the core metal boundary around the globe. Unfortunately, the remaining 55% are very hard to sample, and that's because of combinations of mostly not having seismic stations in the right places, but also not having sources always in the right places. Now, of the 44% of the globe that's been sampled, what's shown in red are places where people have identified funny patches. So we were just talking about the one under Iceland. Well, this is from a summary of, you know, sort of crude spatial resolution. What they tried to take into account is how well resolved do you really know where those seismic waves are at the bottom of the mantle? And so they did, it's not as high resolution as I was just showing you from the Helmberger type work, the Caltech work, but they identify under Iceland, under the southern part of the Hawaiian Islands and the South Pacific, and maybe a few other places, you have these fine patches. In a number of places, they're definitely not there. This, you just have normal sort of mantle. Okay. What's more interesting and much more speculative is there a correlation with these so-called hotspots? Now, I don't want to go into, you know, sort of geology, tectonic theory, but it's just to tell you the prototype of these kinds of hotspots is the chain of islands, the tip of which is the Hawaiian Islands, but this whole chain goes back as the Hawaiian and then Emperor Seamounts all the way back to the Aleutian Trench. So the interpretation is this is a frozen-in remnant, if you want, of a jet of hot rock that comes up over geological time above, with the Pacific crust riding above it, okay? So that as a plate rise up above this hot plume, you get volcanic activity and it generates this chain of, in the case of the Hawaiian Islands, this chain of volcanoes. Iceland has been much more of a stationary plume and is actually a much weaker one by comparison. So there are people who have quantified how much heat is coming out of these various plumes. We're not talking geological timescales and so on. And so the big mother of all geological plumes, mantle plumes, is indeed Hawaii, and is shown by a relatively large symbol in terms of some measure of how much heat is coming out of there. It doesn't matter that it's in mass per unit time. Think of this as a measure of the amount of heat coming out. These are some other proposed hotspots, and although it doesn't show up on the scale, Hawaii dominates by about a factor of 10. In fact, that's why they've converted to these other units, is to make them a little bit more equal. So these are views of the globe from different angles, and simply to make the suggestion by the Santa Cruz group that it looks maybe like you have hot spots at the surface of the Earth that are correlated with these anomalous patches on the Coromandel boundary. And that's about as good as it gets. Now, to me, this is a little bit in the eye of the beholder. I don't have a problem with this conclusion, but I'm not sure they've really proven it. And I'm particularly disturbed by this kind of argument because, in a way, the worse you make your resolution in the actual observations, the better the correspondence. So, you know, I'm giving you the most critical view is that, well, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. But the fact is, at face value, this.
There seem to be several hotspots in the cold part as well.
Yeah, that's partly, yeah. So I've really tried to say there are some naysayers, but I think the community is at the very least intrigued. No one's, I mean, they got this published, first of all, and no one's saying this is total junk. It's people are saying that, saying, oh, that looks interesting, but there are some problems. And I actually think a lot of this can be resolved with time by getting better spatial resolution with the seismic waves. Problem is, and you'll know this from optics, that any of these, if there really are hot zones, plumes, they're theoretically expected to be relatively narrow, but more important than that in a way is that you really do expect the seismic wave velocities to be low, and so you'll get defocusing of seismic waves around these plumes. In fact, they're just intrinsically really, really, really hard to image, including at the base. It's very hard to image these plumes.
So a possible outcome of a higher resolution is to find little hotspots under each one of these things.
It could be.
Why should they come straight up?
This is another very controversial argument. Did I sound like I was supporting this idea? I think it's intriguing, but the fact is, I'm totally neutral. And there's another reason why I'm totally neutral, which is that, in fact, there are huge trade-offs in how you model these funny patches. And let me just show you one kind of trade-off that had not been looked at. These are now purely synthetic seismograms, so model against model for different distances. But it relates to one of the set of observed seismograms that I showed you. For the different kinds of velocity variations, this is a few percent variation in compression on shear wave velocity. These are for tens of percent variations in compression on shear wave velocity. But we did an extra set of calculations, which was what happens is you vary not just the compression on shear wave velocity, but also the density. And it turns out that you can find a whole suite of models where you're contrasting density, compressional velocity, and shear wave velocity, and match the data. Now, I could try and convince you by, for example, showing you one piece of data, like this one in red, and a whole suite of models. And you can compare, this is compressional shear wave velocity perturbation. These first three don't have any density variation. This one has a very large one. But that's not very useful. So instead, you have to do this for all sorts of distances. So instead, what you do is make a trade-off of successful trade-off sheet, if you want, or successful models. because there's the thickness of the anomaly, there is the wave velocity perturbation, there's the density perturbation, and in fact there are two wave velocity perturbations. What's shown here is the compressional wave perturbation, but also a shear wave velocity perturbation. So how do we put this all together? We look at models for different thickness of zones, and let me just make an aside. Notice we're talking about very thin zone, probing down at nearly 3,000 kilometers depth. We're looking at patches that are only 5, 10, 20 kilometers thick. They have to be very, very thin to get the proper kind of waveguide phenomenon. The wave velocity variations we're looking at are on the order of tens of percent. And in fact, the thinner the zone, the larger percentage velocity variation you need to build up the right travel times. It's nothing really profound. What we did was we explored cases in which the shear wave and the compressional wave velocity co-vary one-to-one. We need to have a velocity decrease. In any case, the sign has to be negative. We also looked at the case where shear wave velocities vary three times more, get three times more negative than the compressional wave velocity. That's this yellow sheet energy. So a lot of models are summarized in here. What we find is we need to have a velocity decrease, both compressional and shear wave, but with thickness being a variable, we can also accommodate an increase in density by tens of percent, okay? We cannot accommodate a decrease in density. We have to have an increase in density. So now that is intriguing to us because the kinds of density variations that exist in the rocky part of the mantle due to temperature effects, what drives plate tectonics and all that, it's on the order of percent. Dave has looked at this. Many people have looked at this. Purely dimensional for analysis. Thermal expansion effects are on the order of percent. The only way you can get tens of percent variation is with composition. And if you open your mind to that possibility, the fact is the core mantle boundary is off the scale at a 100% higher density than the mantle. Okay, so it's very easy if you're willing to talk about some chemical interactions with the core to bring in tens of percent variations. So,
is there other data on the thickness separate?
Yeah.
Scattering or something.
None of it, it's very high resolution. Let me show you the other set of data.
Could this be a penetration of the iron?
Yeah, that's one possibility. It doesn't have to be that way. And I've gone on long enough that I won't give you all of the trade-offs. What I'm going to say is it doesn't have to be on the mantle side. What we've done is all of the modeling here really says that either at the bottom of the mantle, you have something that's more core-like, or you can also take at the very top of the core something and make it more mantle-like. I won't belabor it, but I'll just show you a comparison of theoretical versus theoretical seismograms as a function of distance being probed. It's for the same geometries that I showed you the data for. This is where we put the anomaly at the bottom of the mantle, core-like material, low velocity if you want, at the bottom of the mantle. This is where we put mantle-like material right at the top of the outer core, very, very thin. And all you're supposed to see is that the blue and the red model curves match each other perfectly. You can't tell the difference, okay? So now we know there's something funny going on down there.
It wouldn't be an ultra-low velocity, is it?
No, it would be a, I guess, that's right. So it would be a slightly rigid zone. Or I don't even want to debate the issue. I think of these as just fuzzy patches.
These are high bumps.
Okay, so how can you get this? There are a couple of ideas, and unfortunately,
it can't be liquid, right?
It has to have a little bit of shear modulus. Yeah, absolutely. So the point is, there's huge ambiguities, as often the case. This is the geometry of the sort of optics experiment we're doing. Compared with normal core mantle boundary, which presumably has some topography on it, that's a bit of a controversial subject, you can either have this low velocity at the base of the mantle, and this is way too optimistic, over a width range of about 5 to 15 kilometers, or you can have a slightly stiff layer at the top of the core of the order of 1 to 5 kilometers. So it's a little smaller, but close to comparable. Or you can simply smear out the mantle core boundary over a few thousand meters.
You can't just do it with topography.
No.
Even if you make the topography show.
No, because you need to build up the coherency. in the waveguide effectively in here. And I didn't make the point, but one of the reasons that this is very sensitive to density contrast is because we're really talking about waves that rattle along in this waveguide. So they're a reflection against normal mantle as well as against so-called normal core. Basically, their reflection within this anomalous zone depends on the impedance contrast. So that has density built into it. So density comes in, yeah.
I'm confused about the lack of topography. Couldn't you interpret these little solid pieces into the?
They could be. I'm just saying. Maybe I take it back. I misunderstood your question. The normal discussion about topography on the fundamental boundary is very long wavelength. No, you could bring in very high frequency topography. Absolutely, and just make it blurry relative to the wavelength of the seismic waves. I'm sorry, I totally glitched on that. In the future, there may be some ways of distinguishing. Let me give you an idea. There's a problem here, and this is the one technical comment I'll make. What happens is that the seismologists looking at these seismic waves are looking at waves that have very, very long periods, relatively speaking, for doing good imaging. These are periods of typically waves with frequencies of periods of several seconds, several to almost 10 seconds sort of periods. In the future, if we really can learn enough about the mantle, this is hugely speculative, one may be able to do scattering studies to tell the difference between these theoretically calculated models. This is no anomaly at all. This is the low velocity at the bottom of the mantle. This is the high velocity at the top of the core. This is just the fuzzy core mantle boundary. I don't think we'll ever be able to probe this directly with seismic waves, but doing scattering studies, if you know how to sum quasi-coherently a lot of data, you may be able to get resolution, then it'll have to be at periods a factor of 10 higher than we normally can. So the reason we can't probe this with seismic waves is because of all of the scattering, and especially the attenuation in the mantle up above. So normally you cannot see these offsets between, in this case, between different models at a fraction of a second, because you just don't have that high frequency data. Let me finish.
The data doesn't exist or hasn't been analyzed?
It doesn't really exist, because what you extract out are data that have been filtered through the mantle, where the high frequency part has been filtered out by the attenuation and the scattering on the mantle.
So how would it be done? It's not observable?
No, I'm speculating, but there may be ways of doing some scattering analyses where you take redundant wave paths over the same patches and possibly cross-cutting, and look at the, trying to take out a coherent image so that you get effectively a higher frequency sampling but averaged out over a broader area. There may be ways of doing that. It's the analogy with Simon optics and with radar and stuff like that. It's quite speculative. So let me just say the last thing, and this is something that, again, Dave knows about, which is this work of Bruce Buffett, my colleague up at British Columbia. This really goes back to his thesis work where he looked at the VLBI signal for the mutations of the Earth, and actually his emphasis was on one particular part of that signal. Now the wobble of the Earth has been studied for many, many decades, I guess even for centuries in its own right. What's shown here actually the deviations in milliard second as a function of time. It's a particular signal that has a yearly periodicity, and there's actually a 18 and a half year component on the background. And quite frankly, when he was doing this, his original work back in the mid-80s, there was a huge deviation between what was observed and well-observed and what was theoretically predicted from everything one thought one knew about the Earth. Now, everything's dominated, of course, by atmospheric, ocean effects, and so on, near-surface phenomena. But what he was intrigued at was that he was able to beat down the discrepancies for several components of the nutation spectrum. So these are prograde and retrograde components, especially this annual retrograde and this nearly 20-year retrograde component, by invoking one more piece of physics down at the mantle core boundary, which was an electromagnetic coupling. So this is an idea. It's not unique, but this really does give you, if you want, full theory simply means electromagnetic coupling, gives you a means to match the full mutation spectrum within the estimated uncertainties without messing up any other of the, if you want, mutational modes that are already well explained. So that was one of the issues. And so the basic idea is that the magnetic field is created in the outer core, the fluid outer core, the dynamo magnetic field lines emerge from the core metal boundary, but to the degree that they intersect patches of high electrical conductivity that are embedded within the mantle or that are rigid relative to the mantle frame of reference, then the magnetic field lines get, if you want, hung up or caught up or deflected around those patches. And that's all that's needed. Now, the modeling is not unique, but the good news is that the kinds of parameters that he needs to invoke are incredibly reasonable and possibly not all that observable. He only needs a thickness, a patch of high electrical conductivity of the order of hundreds of meters. Thousands of meters is okay, but beyond that, he can't tell the difference. It's literally hundreds to a few thousands of meters is all you can see. I've shown it as a zone, a rigid electrically conducting zone. Actually, you do a bit better with the theory if you make it patchy rather than one particular zone. But the fact is, those are the kinds of details that one can talk about. And so just to be a little bit perverse about things, we proposed recently not reactions between the mantle and core, but essentially the other way around, stuff coming up from the core and floating up to the surface. Bruce liked to call these sediments. I think they were more like foam on a cappuccino or something like that. The point is that either way, as long as you can get some stuff that's piled up against the mantle core boundary or that's infiltrated in, and so let me just say, this would be coming back to Stan's earlier suggestion. This had been a previous favorite of mine, and I don't think we can tell the difference. The other way is you can simply say, well, there's topography and some of the dense liquid from the core infiltrates and permeates down into the regions where the mantle has been pushed down into the core. And again, the kind of topography you need to invoke is on the order of only hundreds to thousands of meters, totally within seismic resolution. So either way you want to do that, unfortunately, either way you want to have this interaction between mantle and core, stuff being like with chewing gum put up against the ceiling, or material infiltrating in, the point is you do need some patches of high electrical conductivity. The simplest way to invoke that is metal, which is high density, low seismic wave velocities, it fits everything. And I just wanted to finish off with the one last point, which Ron made. One of the reasons this is exciting, either way, that you either patches that are infiltrating in as liquid core or stuff being put up onto the core metal boundary as floating sediments, the fact is that the thermal conductivity of iron and iron alloys is something like an order of magnitude higher than the thermal conductivity of oxides. Now, this is a combination of experimental data. It actually is all data-based. Even for the oxides, this is based on making measurements in a laser-heated diamond anvil cell. And so that's nothing new. You know that just at ambient conditions. So that tells you that if you have any places where either high electrical conductivity material has been stuck onto the core metal boundary or somehow some core material is infiltrated, you have patches that are high electrical conductivity but also be high thermal conductivity. What that means is there are places laterally variable where, let's say, in normal mantle, you'd have a normal so-called thermal boundary layer at the base of the mantle. In regions where there's been an enhancement of the amount of metal placed against the mantle, you'll have an enhanced heat flow, basically a jet of heat can come out of these patches of the core. Now, this is very speculative again. It's speculation upon speculation. In the particular model we had here, we were invoking this for infiltration. But it doesn't really matter. The same basic idea holds. And so I just wanted to say the reason that people are focusing on all these issues that then Ron is looking at from a condensed matter theory point of view is really trying to tie together the bigger picture of the mantle dynamics. And so we've talked about the possibility that there are hot upwelling plumes. Well, we see evidence of hot jets near the surface of the Earth. Might these relate back to these patches, these anomalous patches of the core metal boundary? We're not sure. There's some hints that they might. There are some suggestions that these patches are maybe associated with partial melting on the one hand, but on the other hand, maybe they're stuff that's being piled on from the core. Either way you look at it, just the fact that you would have high electrical and therefore high thermal conductivity material embedded at the core mantle boundary makes these sort of hot zones for the base of the mantle, the flip side, if you want, of the hot spots we see at the surface of the Earth. That's what was driving a lot of our trying to understand how do we interpret these experiments in terms of the background kind of theory that people like Tom can provide. So that's just under an hour, but that's about the best I can give you as background. Yeah.
Could you tell, in heliocentric, in seismology, you did not mention the solid part of the core.
Yeah,
does that not show up at all?
It does. It's a different part of the record. It absolutely does show up. It turns out, I don't have a figure. Well, let me see if I can go back. It turns out it's actually remarkably difficult to image it by traveling seismic waves. There are seismic waves generated by earthquakes that travel not only through the rocky mantle and the liquid outer core, but through the inner core and come back out the other side. It's actually very hard to, no one has yet been able to use that kind of observation to actually image a wave that traveled through the inner core as a shear wave. So far, it turns out the properties of the inner core have not been convincingly proved or documented by this kind of observed wave. The wave goes through, you can see the wave, but clearly distinguishing one wave that's a compressional wave in the inner core versus one that's a shear wave has not been done. And instead, the properties of the inner core have actually been best probed by the free oscillation of the Earth. And that's why it's so amazing that you actually can do that, and sort of the terrestrial version of heliopsychology.
The conducting patches would seem to be preferably placed on the tops of the rising plumes in the inner core. Either the sedimentation rate or the
penetration rate. So that's, if I may put it this way, one more level of either speculation or one more consequence. And so that's something that you can go back and start testing. For example, if you like the Glassmeyer type of modeling, you can try and look, does this make sense in terms of the kinds of heat flow that you would expect with the flow fields that he has? Now, granted that what Glassmeyer does and what the Harvard group does and now several other groups, there are a lot of, you know this very well, huge simplifications that have to be made. But it would be still very interesting to see if one can either rule out or tend to reinforce any of those kinds of models based on looking at those consequences.
Gary doesn't have a resolution in his model, I don't think.
Well, and there are other issues, how it deals with the boundary conditions.
Yeah.
It's not to pick on him at all. I mean, all of those guys, they have to do do very simple
things. But he assumes some sort of conductivity in the mantle.
Yeah. Incidentally, as is the case with Jeremy, they've been very interested in trying to think of ways they might be able to probe laterally variable thermal conductivity or laterally variable heat flow in a way to test some of these ideas also. And they've done some work that's been very nice, but it's hard to know how far they can go because the spatial resolution, again, is very low. Coming back to it, I mean, it all comes down to FEO and trying to understand.
Well, I mean, it's not just FEO, actually. Any iron-bearing mineral, whatever's down there, may do interesting stuff. I mean,
so
perovskite, if it's there, may also do something.
That's right.
The sediments are iron silicates.
That's in that particular model. I don't want to oversell it. It was almost just to be ornery. We said, well, you don't have to make this stuff from above. You can make it from below. But let's stand back and generalize. Basically, for an Earth-sized terrestrial planet, these processes become really interesting and important. It's not the case for a Mars-sized planet. And we think we understand much better what's going on in a Mars-sized planet where the pressures are limited to just the outer part of the Earth's mantle. So the core mantle boundary for Mars is corresponds essentially to the base of the upper mantle for the Earth. And that's very well understood phenomenology. More important for prejudices that people like Ron and I share, it's not in a high enough pressure regime to become interesting from a bonding and electronic state point of view. And I'm oversimplifying grossly.
Well, except grossly. The iron sulfide, this stuff interesting in lower pressures.
I'm oversimplifying grossly, but the fact is that we think the community has a better handle on what might be going on for a Mars-sized object, whereas Venus, Earth, or let alone a larger terrestrial object, gets into a pressure regime where you can really start changing the electronic bonding states. And that's the kind of thing that I think we absolutely have to turn to theory to try and, first of all, figure out what experiments should we do, and second of all, once we've done them, how do we interpret them? Ron knows that we've been total fans of his kinds of calculations, because we occasionally try and even check them out, and in one particular case, we worked very hard at it because he'd been beating on us in the community, telling us we should find something, and we all told him to go away. And 15 years after he started beating on us, we finally looked at it, and he was right. So, I think I can say this as an experimentalist. The theory was pretty useless to us, say, 10, 20 years ago. But in the last decade or decade and a half, it's come to a level where experimentally we can't ignore the theory. We absolutely pay attention to that.
Make sure you have your view graphs copied.
Okay, it's a deal. Well, I'll do that once I get reimbursed. Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question about the topography at the Portland interface? What parameters are this varying around the spherical surface to give you topography?
Okay, so it's a very complicated. Yeah, at first it would seem like it's a really simple problem, but it's complicated. Let's back off. We think that the dynamic state characterized by, let's say, the velocities in the outer core versus the mantle, we're talking about a factor of six, seven orders of magnitude there. It's looking at the magnetic field variations for the core versus the rate at which continents move around for the mantle flow. Very different regime. We think correspondingly the viscosity of the outer core is like that of water, sort of centrifuges in old-fashioned units, versus the mantle, which is, you know, it's at least 20 orders of magnitude more stiff. So giving you that as background, the fact is that just the flow in the mantle itself will induce a dynamic topography, just as we see a dynamic topography at the surface of the Earth. So imagine that's like a fountain effect where it, I think I'm speaking down to you, right? And you understand that if you have an upwelling flow, it'll tend to deform a surface up above and pull out the surface below. Okay, that's part of it. Another part of it is to the degree that coupled to this, there are other sources of density variation, like composition. While I've been focusing on mantle core reactions and stuff like that, but even without that, as Ron mentioned, there are some indications, and I do actually have one picture of this as we speak, there are indications of material that sort of floods down, possibly from the surface of the Earth, down to the core mantle boundary. This is another one of these seismic tomograms. This is a cross-section from Japan underneath Asia down here. These are high shear wave velocities, these are shear wave velocities. From the surface down to the core mantle boundary, we know that the Pacific plate is sinking underneath Japan, a lot of earthquakes, and that's what they're due to. If you look at this and stand back and really cross your fingers and poke the eye and all the rest, you can imagine that there's a plume of cold stuff that's been sinking down towards the base of the mantle, and maybe even some geologically older stuff has gone down there. And so associated with this are also not just thermal variations, but also the composition of this oceanic crust here is somewhat different from either the mantle or continental crust. So this crud going down, that's a fancy way of saying this crud going down. That, as it piles up in different places, can itself also influence the topography. Now, having said that, the topography down here is going to be dynamic on time scales of geological tectonics, so millions, tens of millions of years. The outer core is dynamic on time scales of years, and the mantle side of the topography will move around, just like at the surface we see it, you know, on time scales of tens of millions of years. So at the surface, you know, what's even the wilder connection is that surface topography, like the uplift of the Himalayas and so on, has influenced climate, we think, over the last tens of millions of years. So one can only imagine that you get a corresponding effect on the climate of the oceanography of the outer core, depending on, and perhaps, totally speculative on what's happening with this topography down here. That's not a claim I'm making, but that's the kind of thing that people in the community like to think about. On the flip side, much of the magnetic community absolutely gets a gut ache at the idea that there are patches of high electrical conductivity because it makes life very miserable for them. Because to the degree they have shielding, effectively, of the magnetic field lines coming out of the core, it says what we measure at the surface of the Earth is a distortion of what's really happening in the source region in the outer core. And my attitude is, you know, I'm sympathetic to them. that may be the way Mother Nature is, and we haven't proven it. But if that is the case, I think they just have to deal with it. They don't like this. What have I misrepresented? Anything? If I did, it wasn't intentional. But Dave will correct it, I'm sure. So, yes.
I have a question. I don't know if it's quite related, but what about when you do plate tectonics? You have this big primordial continent on one side, Gondola.
It's not primordial, but keep going.
It's only a few hundred million years ago.
It's only a few hundred million years ago.
There were probably many such events in the past.
You build up the continents over history, don't you, with the mantle convection?
Yeah, although the geochemists think that they can make a case that most of the continental crust came out early on. They think, I mean, this is very controversial.
So it's been floating around a long time. So
right.
It assembles and gets split up.
Well, there are
fragments that get added, like the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Those are fragments that have been carried across the Pacific and plastered onto the edge. But there's a lot of pratonic mass that goes back billions of years.
But we sidetracked you. You're starting to worry about what happens when you pile up all the continents in one place.
Yeah, or why would that be? Why would that be so that you get everything?
Is that insulated? Get a hot spot underneath?
Okay, so actually, this is an interesting thing. From a thermal point of view, that is counterintuitive because thermally, the continents tend to get pulled apart, and that's been looked at in some detail because if you have an insulation effect, basically it just builds up heat that wants to pull the continents apart. Whereas actually the stuff at the core mantle boundary is the other way around. If you have a zone of high heat flux, it tends to suck in material and actually helps to concentrate it. So I think there's really no explanation per se. It's just the randomness of the flow of the quasi, in quotes, turbulent-like flow on geological timescales. But there's some interesting consequences, for example, for the rotation of the Earth that Dave, among others, has really, I think Dave has been a pioneer in talking about this. So I've been speculating enough. I can speculate about what this could say about the rotation of the Earth.
About?
If the moment of inertia of the entire planet is shifted around.
Yeah, actually, I could talk about that.
There you go.
I had no intention of doing
it. I knew I had to draw him out. He's such a shy character. But you can, and this is actually something that's been worried about, not just for the Earth, but about other planets.
These are the gold rush tumor bugs?
Things like that.
Yeah. Say something about that.
So, and actually, I mean, what I don't know how much work has gone on is to combine thinking about that in terms of reorienting the planet versus giant impacts. As people have sort of talked about both, and I don't know that anyone stood back and talked about this from a more general point of view.
And what about the impact that formed the moon? That has completely disappeared over, you know, 4 billion years in terms of the structure of the mantle?
If it happened.
In terms of lateral structure, yes. In terms of what it might have done to the chemistry, perhaps not. Mm-hmm. Might have a chemical signature.
Mm-hmm. Or the spin orientation.
Thermal signature, and in the sense of the initial temperature of the core, for example. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so actually that's another interesting issue, is to what extent is the heat that's coming out of the Earth and the heat that's driving all the geological processes really primordial from the accumulation of the planet, but including the giant impact as being part of that accumulation process. In my opinion, the community, although it doesn't tend to talk about this very openly, has had the pendulum has swung a little bit where that's much more in favor of the importance of primordial heating than it was, say, 20 years ago, in large part because of the recognition that there can be a huge amount of energy dumped deep into the Earth associated with the moon forming impact and more generally with accumulation of the planet. So, I mean, I don't know if you have a different view of this than I do, but it's, one doesn't even need to really invoke all that much, let's say, radioactive heating. I'm not saying it isn't there, it's just that you can do a whole lot with primordial heating and just putting together the planet.
My impression of the radioactivity distribution is there's nothing in the core. There's a lot in the crust.
And almost nothing?
There may be something in the mantle?
There may be. But well, what's in the mantle is definitely much less than the crust, any way you argue it. But those who favor a fair amount in the mantle, it's still much less than in the crust. It's just, you know, there's some uncertainty there, whether it's fat down by 3 orders of magnitude or only 2.5 orders of magnitude.
Is this gassium mostly, or?
Uranium, depending on who you talk to, you can actually have enhancement of all, well, potassium, uranium, and thorium are the dominant ones for the Earth. Now, to put more complexity in the issue, and this is a theme we had in the first week, people like me as an experimentalist, I want to look at the possibility that there might be potassium or uranium in the core because I can do experiments there. So, you know, there's a bias from us experimentalists saying, well, this might be an interesting question because if I can show that experimentally, if you take a silicate that has a little, you know, parts per billion or parts per million of potassium, uranium, or thorium, some combination, put it in contact with metal and show that some significant amount goes into the core, then I can make your life more difficult as a modeler and, you know,
I see, that's the real motivation.
I just, yes, back to this theme, it's very important, but, you know, the optimistic side is it's really important to keep on throwing into the bucket of ideas different ways of looking at these issues.
Yeah, I don't remember the story very well, but I thought that looked like the rest of the Earth was short of potassium.
Okay, so it is, based on analyses, and so one interpretation, I think there's no question, some of the potassium has been blown off. What is, again, it's a volatility issue.
Yeah, but no more so than sodium or whatever. Right. So
one
that's right. So there's no, I mean, this doesn't prove that there's no potassium in the core. But if you said that the reason why the Earth is depleted in potassium is just volatility, it fits the trend. There are standard diagrams.
The same depletion,
but there's a standard diagram where you put in, you know, depletion as a, and you list the elements in, with
so
volatility.
You have to put sodium in the core too.
But then you're just making the horrible market, because then you have to say that the entire trend that can be naturally understood by volatility is attributed
so
to
really
sodium and it doesn't really work in detail because there are elements that we know are siderophile and you know you understand the difference as a function of how siderophile they are.
But, you know, it's also the condensed matter and the chemistry community that have weighed in because it was first theoretically predicted and has been experimentally shown that potassium does take on a transition metal-like character at high pressures, and you can actually make transition metal alloys involving potassium. So that suggests the possibility that you could actually bind some potassium down there. What has not been quite as supported, what you really need to do is look at, given that it might be happy binding to iron, the potassium doesn't necessarily go preferentially into iron.
You've got to do a partitioning experiment.
And
you can't just
to my knowledge, there have been only a few partitioning experiments done, and they tend not to support this idea. But, you know, more work needs to be done, et cetera, et cetera.
Under reducing conditions, you can also put uranium in iron.
Exactly.
That's been shown, even at low pressure. So
it's a wide open area, and my view is these things have to be looked at, and then you try and critically shoot down as many of these new possibilities.
So most of the reason the radioactive is in the crust is all oxidized, right? I mean, it's just
oxidizing.
Reactive materials.
Well, no, it's just incompatible to melt, so it goes into the liquid.
Yeah, but that's another way. Different terminology.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
But it's only a really strong effect in continental crust. And continental crust is a small fraction of the total volume of the Earth. And so in the end, when you do the arithmetic, most of the radioactives are still in the mantle.
But it's still numerically important, right? I mean, you can't just leave
it out.
I mean, most of the radioactive is still in the mantle.
I mean, if you believe the standard estimates for uranium and thorium, so the ones that matter most for the present, they're mostly.
So you count the ones that are in the crust and there isn't enough there?
It's just that the crust is such a tiny volume.
Because it's a tiny volume, even though it's huge.
It's the same story as with hydrogen on the planet, that, you know, a number of us in the high pressure community talk about most of the Earth's water actually being in the rock at depth, rather than the oceans and atmospheres dominated by the large volume of the mantle, basically. Because then you don't need
the density is much lower in the mantle, but the total quantity can.
That's exactly right. The density is not by order of magnitude. So, all right.
But do we know the Earth is intrinsic flux?
Of heat?
Yeah.
No, actually, and this gets to be a technical issue, because for the continental areas where historically you have a lot of data, you have to correct for the fact that a lot of the measured heat flow is due to this locally radioactively produced heat flow. So then you go to the ocean floor, and the good news is that there's a huge number of measurements in the past few decades. The bad news is that it's very largely perturbed by hydrothermal circulation through the oceanic crust. So, you know, there are problems on all sides in terms of getting the numbers absolutely right. But the value at the, you know, the sort of 70 milliwatt per square meter value is pretty well agreed to.
So, I mean, currently,
10 to the 13th?
Yeah, I was going to use CCS, I'm sorry. But it's 10 to the 13th. But just to illustrate the difficulty of this problem, if you go to books around about 1975 and look in those books, you'll get three. But this trend, it's not likely to come down again. So it really does look as though it's at least this large. And the other thing is to ask, what's the radioactivity component? And of course, you don't really know it. But the people who strive very hard to figure this out only get 2 by 10 to the 12. And this is called this ratio is called the Urey number.
So it's about half, and the other half, therefore, has to come from the core.
Unit there is Erds per what?
Erds per second.
But that's
watts, if you like, if you want to take off some orders of magnitude.
Right,
so
But that's with radioactivity in the mantle as well? Or?
No,
all radioactivity that you could reasonably attribute to the Earth, no matter where it is.
No matter where it is,
assuming it's steady state.
But it is actually mostly in mantle. And this is also the number that you will get if you take a potassium depleted chondritic composition.
That's right.
That doesn't mean the Earth is that, but that's roughly what it is.
And why did that number go up between 1975 and today?
Because
this is from here to here, just because people did a better job in the oceans and also the continents. There were no measurements whatsoever in Antarctica and a lot of South America at this time. So there have been continental measurements added as well, some of which turned out to be a bit higher than they expected. But a lot of it is better job in the oceans. It's hard to do.
I guess I'm asking, why would those old measurements be too low? And why would you ever measure the fluxes too low?
Too low because they underestimated what's coming out of the oceans, and because they did not have measurements for a lot of the continents.
So it's very differential.
Can you get away from space? I mean, you know how much the energy absorbed by the sun is?
So let's make it clear.
Can you do it the other way around, like, from the energy?
You mean actually measure from Earth orbit?
No, this is
a factor of 5,000 smaller than the energy from the sun.
Yeah.
And you're really, actually, it's not completely ridiculous, but you can't do it. I mean, but it's not a completely ridiculous idea. People have thought about doing that, but that's really, really, really
hard.
You need to have an exquisitely good bolometric measurement. You have to make sure that you cover the wavelengths, et cetera, et cetera.
And by then you would have solved the global climate change. No, but that's actually a big part of it. So coming back, the problem is, even in across the oceans, most of the heat flow comes out of the mid-ocean ridges, plus or minus several hundred kilometers. So unless you have good spatial sampling along there, you just don't have a good average for the whole planet. And so that was required, but it's worse than that, because what people then realize is a lot of actual measurements near the mid-ocean ridges gave very low apparent values until it was realized that in a lot of cases they're getting biased measurements because they're looking at the effects of an internal circulation of water within the crust So wherever the cold water is being sucked in to feed, you know, these hydrothermal vents and so on at the Middle Ocean ridges, they're getting an anomalously low value. And people have to realize we have to strip those away. And then, quite frankly, the best numbers come out of a model fitting to the data that exists. On land, Dave's absolutely right. You know, you'd be amazed, but it takes a long time after you drill the hole to be able to go back in and make a measurement of the gradient of temperature. You know, we're talking about fractions of a degree variations. You have to worry about how much frictional heating there was while you drilled that hole and how it's come back into equilibrium. A lot of that, you know, it's by trial and error, but that literally took decades to fully understand all the issues involved there. It's a very rich field, actually. Turning it around, though, I do think that our colleagues at Michigan, Pollack and so on,
But
better than that, by analyzing global data, they think that they
can get global
warming out of this, which is quite amazing. It's really remarkable.
When you drill, it's a fascinating thing. You know, if the temperature of the Earth were constant with time and you had uniform conductivity properties, then as you went down into the Earth, the temperature profile should look like this. But in fact, they don't see that. What they see is a curvature, which is consistent with the idea that you had a previous profile and you then warmed up the surface.
Yeah.
So it's developed a curvature, and they can actually measure this curvature. Presumably it goes back on the straight line at depth, but you can actually measure the curvature and say something about change in surface conditions on a time scale that is this depth squared over
the meter.
So they're sampling it in a diffusive sense,
changes.
It's just like the diurnal cycle of temperature in the Earth, except it's on a much longer time
scale. Is that like glacial time scale?
That's one of the things.
That's exactly right.
David, this figure, 42 times 10 to the 20 Earths per second, the heat emission from the Earth, the entire Earth, that's totally new to me. How does that compare with the energy coming from the sun?
It's 5,000 times smaller.
5,000 times smaller. Okay, right.
So that's why you can't do a volumetric measurement to do this. It's just too small.
5,000 times, is that the amount hitting the Earth? And it
comes back opposite. Probably the
albedo.
Almost equal. Yeah, almost. That's the whole, the whole global climate problem.
Well, the radiative balance of the Earth, of course, is achieved quicker on any time scale that we're interested in. So even if you fiddle around with the albedo, you still have, as a radiated balance, energy in it pulls energy out, except a tiny change in heat content in the atmosphere, which is infinitesimal compared to the ones we're talking about. So you never get an imbalance between solar energy in and solar energy out, except for the tiny changes in heat content in the system.
Yeah,
right.
Most
things.
That kind of changes.
Well, this is actually solar energy, but it's still tight. Compared to these fluxes we're talking about.
Most of that storage is probably water vapor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most of that storage is which one?
In water vapor?
Actually, I think in the oceans, isn't it? Most of it is.
No, as far as the atmosphere.
Atmospheric
storage
is mostly water.
On 1,000-year time scales, presumably you put energy in the ocean as well. I mean, of course, that's what Walter Monk is trying to measure. Walter has this experiment where they set off acoustic signals in Heard Island north of Antarctica, between Australia, roughly, and Antarctica. And these signals propagated as acoustic waves in a waveguide that the ocean forms near the base of the uppermost warm layer and the underlying colder but saltier layer. And there is a natural waveguide there. And the propagation speed of those acoustic waves depends on the temperature of the water. And so he was hoping to see a change in the propagation time for signals that started in Heard Island and ended up 10,000 miles later, right here, in Monterey.
I've not seen any results of those experiments.
They have results. They have measurements.
They have results. I don't know.
Do they have a change, or do they have?
They have some change variations, but the problem is you have to then correlate with other measures of change to unravel everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is also some multipathing. North of New Zealand, there's some complications about whether the signal goes on one side or the other side, and, because there's some shallow ocean there. So you can imagine circumstances where the ray path goes one way or goes the other way, depending on the depth of the ocean.
I would think the time scale for the warming would be long compared.
Although he's, I forget the numbers, but the claim is that you could see one degree change easily.
I see.
Yeah. And I've heard that he has direct evidence of that now after taking out the sea surface variation of time. But I have not seen that published now. I've just heard that in a talk of his too long ago. It's an incredible experiment. And with time, I think it really will be very decisive. I'm not sure that would influence our current president one way or the other.
Should have
Walter
up for a talk.
Yeah, you should, because I think he's got a neat story if he's willing to talk about it.
Walter, of course, has had a very bad experience because of the business of the whales.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But he won, didn't he?
He won. He won.
Like the guys on, was it Mount Lemmon? There's some ground squirrel up there. I could never understand what effect another telescope on the top of that mountain had on the ground surface.
Well, I thought a lot of that was had to do also with sort of the concept of desecration of the land. I thought there was a Native American involvement.
You mean a cemetery or something?
No. Well, I think part of the concept is constructing, any big building is considered a desecration of the land, which is, with all due respect, there's a certain element of truth to that, right?
Malkia being the case.
Exactly. There you go. But I think this thing with the whales, quite frankly, the winners were the biologists, because they got quite a bit of research money, and I think there's been far more study of whale behavior as a result of this ruckus that was raised, even though there's some serious questions as to how much it was done purely cynically and how much it was done because of real concern.
So hadn't they thought the expertise is acoustic waves were interfering with the whales?
Yeah, that was the point. But the fact is the ocean is an incredibly noisy place, and you're not about, the main sources of noises are just surface ships, right?
What's the frequency of Walter's?
It's a tenth of a hertz or 10 hertz, I can't remember.
It's not much below our audio range. It's sort of like the bass that's produced at rock concerts.
How does he generate power?
The signal generator is not too much different than what produces the lowest frequency sounds in a large rock concert.
Just a big speaker.
Yeah.
So was it the same wave of explosion or some
no.
kind of...
No, it's a continuous source. Well, there may be pulses, but
that's right.
But it's basically a continuous source.
Right.
Probably need pulses, I think, to do the timing right.
And what its power consumption is.
It's pretty high.
I bet it is, yeah.
But in fact, these sounds are really audible. It is, that sound channel is quite amazing.
That's the waveguide is really necessary, isn't it?
Otherwise,
you lose the stuff to dissipate.
Yeah, that's right.
We have it here in Santa Barbara sometimes, when you get the inversion.
Uh-huh.
The layer of cold air at the bottom acts like the waveguide. I can hear the freeway in my house, like it's right outside.
Well, that was also the whole story with those booms off of Long Island, Concord and stuff. That, people find it hard to believe that you could transmit sound energy that far, but if you get the right kind of waveguide conditions, it really does happen. Mm-hmm. Now can we get lunch?
I'm running out of. Are you here, Bristol?
I'm here today.
I have another question on my name.
Okay, I just have to plug in my computer.
Why are there two batteries? Why are there two signs?
Yeah, I was going to do one now. You could give me your email and forget it, and I can ask you.
You heard what I said. My space shuttle comes in, my friends at Vandenberg, we get two moons. A fair fraction of a second.
I know there's an answer to that. I think it's a reflection, but I'm not sure. I can get their references on this. So people have published on this in GRL. I think there is a reflection, but I just don't know. I know it's been looked at.
Because there's just one shockwave, isn't there?
Right.